all men are not equal, and neither are their crimes. Jack McClintock. Welcome to This Fruitful Mind. My name is Kevin McCormick and I've got a fruitful mind. This is my podcast about everything and anything, but mostly anything. All opinions expressed by my guests are their own, and all opinions expressed by me are either my own or belong to the voices in my head. Please be advised that this podcast contains occasional swear words. Yay! Hello, my fruitful friends. Thank you for joining me. This episode is titled Meet the Sin Eater Part 2. In conversation with Jack McClintock. And it is a continuation of my conversation with retired prison psychologist Jack McClintock in the previous episode. If you've just stumbled upon my podcast for the first time, I recommend you please listen to Meet the Sin Eater Part 1 before listening to this episode. Thanks to those who messaged to say how much they enjoyed my first conversation with Jack, and I know you are going to love Part 2. I'll say no more for now and just play the second part of my interview with Jack for you, and I'll talk to you again at the other end. I'm back again with my friend stateside Jack McClintock, live and direct from Massachusetts. We were, in the previous episode, we were talking about his memoir, Sin Eater, his yet to be published book, but we'll get to the publication plans by the end of this conversation. The book is Sin Eater, Memoirs of a Prison Psychologist. And towards the end of our last conversation, I had touched upon something with Jack that piqued his interest. What I wanted to do was I wanted to chat a little bit, if we could, Jack, please, just about the whole idea that, you know, outside of the institutionalization of the people within the prison, we could use the term community. But really, at the end of the day, what's inside the prison system is a society, because it is structured the same as the society that we know, in that there's a hierarchy. There is the whole concept of stature. There is the whole concept of those who are bright, sharp, intelligent, manipulative. And within that same society, the same as there is on the outside of the wall where you and I are fortunate enough to live, there are those who are at the other end of the spectrum as well, in terms of their mental capacity and their smarts and their general levels of intelligence. So within that society of the prison service, right, we were talking about, you know, your different experiences and that. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how institutionalized the staff working within these facilities become.
Completely.
So do you maybe want to, because I know like that, you know, you mentioned, and I don't want you giving away too much of your book, right?
Oh, but that's not an issue.
Okay, so maybe if you could tell us about the fire at your first place of work, right? And your first encounter, it was at Walpole, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and the prison warden as well, and how he greeted you.
Yeah.
And maybe this will tie in a little bit as well to the whole idea of the status within the prison system, that when you came to work in the prison first, when you came to Walpole first, despite being there in a professional capacity, you were really kind of down the food chain a bit, Jack, weren't you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Human service workers are below medical service workers. And, you know, you can imagine that in an environment where one guy's got the key and the other guy's got the cage, the guy who's got the key is the angel and the guy in the cage is the devil. So anyone who's trying to help the guy in the cage is an ally of the devil. So, you know, human service workers, psychotherapists, we're trying to keep people from committing suicide, or we're trying to help them with their adjustment to extraordinary circumstances. We are seen as allied with everything that's wrong with American society. That can't help but put some muck on your escutcheon. That can't help but throw a little tar on your suit. And so, yeah, substantially that we were paid relatively well, you know. I was actually given recruitment pay to agree to work at Walpole. But My very first day there, the superintendent, what would be known as a warden, met me in the in the main concourse of the prison at Walpole. It's a large, you could almost land a plane in there. It's so big. It's a main concourse that connects all of the different cell blocks of the prison. And it's called, I have a sign in my office above this door that says the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. And that's what that hallway is known as. In the prison, it's called the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. So I was called along with my new boss, my director of mental health, to meet the warden or prison superintendent outside inner control, which is an armor-plated command center overlooking or looking out onto this boulevard, this hallway. And we were there. He was there with three or four very big, very powerfully bulked up correctional officers and his next in command. And I had been going through the institution. My director was introducing me to correctional officers, affectionately known as COs. I was introduced to the medical staff and to my colleagues in mental health. And I even met some of the other workers in the prison. Things seemed to be going well. So around noon or 1 o'clock, I guess, we were summoned to meet with the superintendent outside inner control in the hallway known as the Boulevard of Broken Dreams. So I'm standing there with my director, my new director, and he's looking rather nervous. And I'm curious about this because he'd been there a long time. Why would he be nervous? I'm trying as hard as I can not to show my nervousness because I want to impress everybody with this is a maximum security prison. I don't want to look like a sissy. So I'm trying to do my best macho impersonation, you know. And so the superintendent comes out with his entourage. And they're all very nice and solicitous and asking me, well, how's your first day on the job? And I'm trying to have a discussion or a conversation with this man I've never met before in the midst of these very big, very formidable looking correctional people and my new director. I had no idea how unusual this kind of attention was. But my director did, and my director was already looking very nervous. So as we're having this discussion, one of the cell blocks empties, and there's a big line of men coming down the boulevard right past us, and the chief of security yells over an inmate's name, a prisoner's name, and the prisoner steps out of line and comes over, and he tells him to halt. The guy halts. Men are still streaming by, mind you. And he introduces me to this guy, and that's nice, you know. He brings him over, and I shake his hand, and the superintendent asks me if I recognize the guy, and I said, well, no, should I? I'm already feeling ill at ease because this is very unusual. And so he tells the inmate, the prisoner, really, to tell me what he's doing time for, and he tells me, well, he's doing time for arson. And everybody's getting, now the superintendent and his chief of staff, they're smiling, and they're smiling rather cold-heartedly. And so the director of security says, what crime did you commit? And he tells him, I burned Worcester State Hospital. Well, this is a man who was standing next to me on the lawn at Worcester State Hospital, where I had worked for years. This is the man who set the hospital on fire. I was standing next to him, talking to him about the fire. There was a psychiatrist that I knew, this young man that I didn't know. And the three of us were standing on the lawn watching this incredibly big, looked like a cathedral had caught on fire. And it was just raging flames, shooting 30, 40, 50 feet in the air, windows breaking. And, you know, it was a vast hospital. It was a very ancient hospital. It was attached to the building that I was working in, which was a newer building, but they were right next to each other. So one could have caught the other on fire. And this made national news for a day or two. It was that big a blaze. And this is the guy that I was the guy I was talking to while we were watching the fire was the guy who set it. And so when this becomes known, the superintendent and his chief break out laughing. They're having a fine time. I was at the hospital. I was a psychologist at the hospital. This man was not my patient. He wasn't even on my ward at the time. But he burned the hospital that I worked at, and I didn't know who he was. And the superintendent and his men thought this was hysterically funny. And all I'm standing there like a dope. You mean you don't recognize the guy who burned your hospital to the ground? Welcome to Walpole. The superintendent, by the way, told me he was assigning this person to me as my first patient. And this, I'm sorry, but this is prison humor. And you couldn't make this crap up. They knew who I was. They knew more about me before I ever entered the door than I knew about any of them when I was leaving 3 years later. This was prison, where everybody knows everything about everybody else. It's that creepy.
Yeah, you'll forgive me now for laughing out loud at that, Jack, because, you know, when I read that in the book, as I said to you, you know, I see this as a movie, you know. It's just an incredible life, an incredible story. And it just, when you disclose that, you know, that this is the guy who you had been standing next to on the lawn, and it transpired that he actually had started the fire in the hospital.
Yeah.
That was just insane. I have to say that I drank my tears. I laughed so hard at that, you know. And I thought, okay, so you got, in the same way that it's kind of like the kid that starts his first day working at a car wash and his supervisor tells him to go out and get a bucket of steam, you know?
Yeah.
It's just that kind of, let's fuck around with the new guy and let's have a laugh at his expense and whatever else. So, you know, while Sin Eater is peppered with little bits of dark humor, that's not dark humor. That's just downright funny, right?
Yeah.
Okay. but there are little bits of it that are peppered with a little bit of dark humor, okay? Which kind of bring a little bit of kind of light relief, because I suppose, you know, there is the old expression of gallows laughter.
Yes.
It's a release. It's a release from how macabre the situation that they're in and what they're witnessing. And so there are moments throughout the book where there is somewhat of a sense of camaraderie, you know, to be found between the correctional officers and that in it. But I think that it took you a while, really, didn't it? From what I've read, it took you a while to get these guys to warm to you. Now, I know that you're not a bullshit merchant, right? And I know that you're the kind of guy, you know, it's a kind of a take it or leave it scenario with you. But by the same token, you know, it's important that you not necessarily fit in, but get along with the people who are, at the end of the day, your colleagues. Now, they met you a lot of the time, and especially in the early days, with quite a bit of disdain, because they saw you as this almost soft and fluffy hippie who was coming in to hold hands with these bastards, you know, tell me about your daddy and how did that make you feel? And, you know, the kind of, when they know that these guys would cut their fucking throat in a split second.
Yeah.
So they failed to see the humanity in it. You alluded a couple of times in the book just to the challenges around that. Do you maybe want to talk a little bit about that, Jack? Just about the kind of the culture that there was within the community of correctional officers in there. And maybe if you could put into context for us as well, given that we're talking about a society within the prison, where did they fit in that society?
The whole business about the culture of prison, there are two cultures. One of them is the inmate convict resident culture. The other is the administrative CO culture, all right? This is the governmental culture. Government is embarrassed by and frequently in contention with or at odds with the correctional institution that it oversees. The officers who work in prisons, and this changes greatly from supermax to maximum security to various levels of medium security, then to minimum and pre-release facilities. The culture varies dramatically with, if you will, the distilled essence of whatever you might think of as evil located in your supermax and max prisons. That's it. You don't need to understand anything else if you get that.
Mm.
The officers who work in these prisons tend to drift through the system. But you'll find that most of the officers, like I did at Walpole, had been there for a very long time, and 5 years in a place like that is a very long time. There were officers there, some of rank, others who were just rank and file officers, COs who'd been there for 10, 15, 20 years. I actually met a correctional officer. He was a captain. His nickname, his prison name was Walpole Wally. And Wally had been assaulted by a group of inmates, maybe 10 years before I got there. And Wally wasn't playing with a full deck, but he was kept on at his pay grade and rank so that he could reach full retirement. Everybody in the prison understood that Wally just pretty much wandered around the prison and didn't do much. He was wearing a uniform and he liked to talk and tell stories. Wally had been stabbed like 17 times in the assault and had very nearly died. And I think he had, he wasn't missing an eye, but I think one of them was glass. And he, you know, he had to piss through a straw. There were bad things that happened to him. But the ultimate result was that emotionally he was broken by the experience. His judgment had become impaired. He was now a functioning alcoholic who had lost his family because of various psychological distresses that he manifested. He was a tragic person who was, by the prison administration, the officer corps carried him, deliberately carried him. They made it possible for him to show up every day and be on the role of employee working day by day to his retirement. Because the officers knew what had happened to him and didn't want him utterly destroyed and bereft and abandoned by the system that had put him in there to a circumstance that had caused this to happen. Now, while I was there, I mean, I loved Walpole Wally. And I used to seek him out when I could see him on duty, when he wasn't someplace drinking a coffee. I would engage him and ask him for more stories, and he always had stories. While I was there, I'm not sure if it was the Suffolk block or the Bristol block, but in one of the cell blocks, there were two officers. Of course, we're always conscious about budget. Can't have too many police officers, correctional officers, because the taxpayers will howl. They get paid this outrageous salary. And so there were two men on. It was a late afternoon. One of them went out to get mail or coffee or some flipping thing. And so the other guy sitting at his desk, the cells are open. And he was attacked by a group of young Hispanic men. Now, others, whites and blacks, joined in, but it was a gang of Hispanics who attacked him with homemade shanks. Do you know what those are?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this would be an implement maybe modeled from a toothbrush or whatever, but a pointed instrument with that would be used to stab somebody.
Yes. Yeah? And so a group of like, I don't know, 14 or so young Hispanic, they all belong to the same or related gangs, came around him at his desk because he's out in the middle of the open, and they stabbed him. I can't remember whether he got stabbed 37 times or 27 times, but it took him, you know, a week to be taken off the critical list. He survived, and nobody understood how. And the story was like this. He'd been left alone on the cell block by his buddy who went out to do something else. They had waited for this opportunity, and they didn't care who was sitting in the chair. It was a CO, and they tried to kill him, and they failed, of course, because you don't get to prison because you're especially smart. You know, you try to kill somebody and fail. What is to be said of you? How incompetent must you be? Anyway, they tried to kill the CO. He survived, you know, by the grace of Allah or whatever God there might be. And I went over to visit him when he was across the street at a hospital that's no longer open. And he was sitting up in his bed with his father, and I went over to show the colors. I went over just to show emotional support. And I'll never forget the look on the young man's face. He'd been conscious for a day or two, and he looked like he was going to cry when I came through the door. He looked like he had been crying when I came through the door, and he had that same look when I left 10 minutes later. It was a very uncomfortable exchange with his father pretty much wanting me to get out of the hospital. I was telling him about his bravery, and he was ready to cry. I was welcoming him back to work. And by the way, he never came back to work. He didn't retire because he didn't have enough time in. he was shattered by the experience of purposeless, undeserved cruelty for no fucking reason, except that the inmates wanted to establish who ran that block. That was the reason given.
It was a political statement.
Well, you can call it politics if you want. I suppose that works. It was a racial incident. It was more than a political one, but it was certainly about power. I don't know about
it. Was a hierarchical? Would you describe it as a hierarchical statement?
Well, you know, that's a contemporary term that you can use it if you want. I saw it as a barefaced attempt to show the superintendent and all of his many minions that this can happen to you too. The thing is, when you go home at night, and I've had COs tell me about, you know, 20 devil's disciples showing up on motorcycles at 11 o'clock on their front lawn of their home to let them know they didn't like the way JoJo was treated. And if you don't think that scares the living shit out of a correctional officer, he's got his wife and his little children in there. He may have a handgun, but that's like the Alamo. You know, if he gets the gun out, of course, in Massachusetts, he's required to have the weapon unarmed, unloaded. You know, it just, there's a whole cascade of things to be said here. But so the men and women who work in the prisons are vulnerable. And when the culture of prison and the culture of criminality, because that's throughout the system at the lower levels, that is the lower level communities. Think of it as part of the correctional system. They surely do. And so you surely should. That community can come knocking at your door or your mother's door or your daughter's door any damn day they want. But let me just back up. So that young man looked, I don't know if he looked horrified. He looked like he was going to cry the whole time I was there. It was clear that he'd been crying before I arrived. I don't know if he ever stopped crying, but his father, when I said, you know, we're all waiting for you to come back to work, his father almost came up out of his chair and yelled at me. It was clear that he wasn't coming back and nobody thought he was. But I wanted to provide support because that's all I could do. So he left.
You wanted to say something in a situation where there was realistically nothing to say.
Yeah. My support was not wanted, and as it turned out, probably wasn't helpful. This kid had almost been murdered for something absolutely trivial, and except for his presence as an employee in the prison, had virtually nothing to do with him. I was there in my third year, and I had already taken over because we had a director of mental health, but then there were other duties like training the COs, stress management. That's a funny story. But I was also in charge of mental health and the departmental disciplinary unit. Who the hell would you choose to be in charge of mental health in the departmental disciplinary unit? None other than Jack Kevorkian himself. It was a match made in heaven or something. So I was standing out behind the wall and near what's called no man's land in the front of the prison. And I was talking to a female sergeant, one of the few females who worked as COs at Walpole. And she was, by the way, another Irish girl, okay? And a nice gal, tough as nails, but a really decent person. And I was talking with her, and there was another, a big Irish guy, you know, Reedy or O'Rourke or something, standing, and the three of us were talking on this concrete pedestal out in front of the main entrance in the interior of the prison. And we were talking about the stresses of working in prison when a CO ran up from the, came out of the outer control area. I can't explain all this. It'd take too long. A CO ran up to her, and I was standing there as he explained to her that her son had just died. Her son was a young man, younger than me, who had for a couple of years been working as a CO in the departmental disciplinary unit. That was where I was now part of the administrative clinical infrastructure. And he explained to her that he had just died. He'd been driving into work as usual with three of his correctional officer buddies. They're all driving their manly motorcycles. And this young man, I won't use any names, drove across the line into the oncoming grill of an 18-wheeler and became a fly speck on the guy's grill. He never touched his brake. Suicide's the chief, the main cause of, one could say, the only cause of death among correctional officers. It's rampant. It's been that way forever. And the same people that are advocates for criminals and civil rights and inmate rights in the prisons give no thought to it. I don't know if they don't applaud, but you know, you either finish a bottle of whiskey and eat the barrel of your Smith & Wesson, or you die from a stroke or heart attack on average, and get ready, drum roll here, okay? These statistics are provable. I mean, I can point you in the right. If you need proof, I can give it to you. I used to teach stress management to these men, correctional officers. They die on average 20 years before the age of mortality for their peers in the state. That's two decades. If they don't commit suicide, and that does help lower the average, then they die from some sort of malady like stress-related heart attack or stroke. And the average age of mortality for a correctional officer is 20 years lower than age peers. I don't know what to say, except if that probably needs to be fixed. But once again, I can illustrate the problem. I can outline the problem. I could talk all day about the problem, but I have no idea how to fix that. I was involved, and this is probably the funniest part of the whole damn book. I was told, I was directed, I was required to take over teaching a stress management class to the COs. Do you remember reading that part?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
Well, nothing could be funnier. I was drinking myself to death and fantasizing about suicide. I was excellent at talking inmates down from who were suicidal. The reason for that great ability wasn't my education. I understood what they were facing, and I was able to relate to them in a way that few others could. To put me in charge of stress management for people who had stress problems was like, I don't know if it gets any funnier. This is Robin Williams funny. This is, you know, this puts Groucho Marx to shame. Henny Youngman's turning in his grave. It does not get any more, Robin Williams would say, ironical. It just doesn't get any funnier. The last guy you'd expect to be teaching these men who are in desperate, dire straits about mass stress management was me, because look at the mess. Look at the mess I was in. I was suicidal. I was drunk half the time. I was picking fights with strangers in bar rooms and coming home, you know, with bloody knuckles. I was out of control, and they wanted me to teach stress management.
That, you know, Charlie Chaplin, there's a quote, and I know that I'm going to make an absolute balls of this, but there's a quote from Charlie Chaplin, and it goes something along the lines of, life in the close-up is a tragedy, but in the long shot, it's a comedy.
Brilliant.
So what you describe there is deadly serious, but darkly.
Very darkly.
hilarious in equal measure.
Yes.
I mean, how do you begin, Jack? How do you begin? Because, you see, at the end of the day, what we are talking about here is that, you know, we're all human. We all have our frailties. I don't like the term weaknesses,
yeah,
but we have our frailties.
Vulnerability.
Right? Our vulnerability, our frailty. We, you know, that's inherent in all of us. We are, you know, we're something in the region of like 90% water. So we are basically, you know, bags of water with anxiety. But yet we expect some people in some professions to be able to function outside of their frailty and outside of their vulnerability. You know, there's almost an expectation that some, like, you know, there could, we could easily take the attitude that you going in as you did as a young man into Walpole, well, he's trained. Okay, so this guy is trained and he knows how to separate himself from what people tell him and from what everything. So we're back then to the whole thing, Jack, I feel, are we, of content versus context? Because the content, we'll say, is that you have people bearing their souls to you, and you have evildoers who are justifying their actions, and people who have just committed absolutely terrible, terrible atrocities, and they're somehow able to rationalize it, and they feel like they're the victim in the whole fucking situation, right? Yeah. And you understanding psychological models, you know, okay, so that's where this thinking is coming from. That's where that thought is coming from for this guy. And you can encourage further conversation, or you can challenge it accordingly and appropriately. But at the same time, the overall, that's the content, but the overall context that you are in is absolutely rotten and confused and terrifying.
Dangerous.
Because really, but it is, it's deadly dangerous. Yeah. So you're working in a system where you have people who are broken and evil and all of these things. It, clearly, the bunch of Hispanic guys that attacked that CEO, they have no interest in ever getting out of prison, to say that they would jump on somebody like that. You know, they're happy to stay there forever. So you're dealing with that mindset. But then the people who are in charge, their heads are just being completely fucked over, aren't they? I mean, like, they're working in situations, and they are becoming, they're breaking, they are falling apart.
They're doing the best they can with what they have in the circumstance they find themselves in. I don't condemn them. The ones I want to give a shiver to, the ones I want to make an appeal to, are the politicians, for sure. But more than that, more so than that, the jurists, the judges, from the Supreme Court, certainly the state Supreme Court, on down, these people really, they're, I'm sorry to do this, I shouldn't, I suppose. There are I won't name politicians, let's just go with this. There are people in Washington who do not know the cost of a gallon of milk, a loaf of bread, or a gallon of gasoline. They do not soil themselves or interact with people who do these, fill gas tanks and buy milk. They don't. They're not there. That's taken care of for them. And over the course of a political career, they have become so detached from daily life that they don't know about, and they do not care to learn about, the cost of a gallon of gas or a gallon of milk. These people are the ones who make the laws based upon understanding of things that I probably can't guess. But they surely do not understand what they need to understand in order to make coherent, successful policies that even begin to touch the issues that you and I are discussing. They are so disaffected that the laws they make can almost not help but make that situation worse. It comes from, and you may want to just edit all this out, it comes from ignorant goodwill and the false reasoning, the false value of mindless compassion. You know, it doesn't mean that you're a good guy if you like cooing babies and puppies dancing around. Hitler liked those things, and he wasn't much of a guy. You know, so, you know, think of the children. Always think, try to be gentle, try to be compassionate, try to be forgiving. I am all of those things. And I realize that not everybody deserves the gift of life. Some people make a really negative contribution to the gene pool. And apparently, out of a fear that justice will not be served if decent men are convicted or killed, the nation as a whole, clinging, I think wrongfully, to Christian principles that have become perverted, insists that we can't risk killing anyone for fear we'll kill the innocent too. You know, that kind of reasoning only belongs in a society which has absolutely failed to render a system of justice that's functional. When you become so afraid that you'll kill innocents that you no longer trust the systems you've put in place, the jurist systems, the correctional and rehabilitative systems, when you don't think that you're not putting innocent people into prison or at risk of terminating innocent people, when you believe that your system is so corroded, so corrupt and incompetent, that that risk outweighs the benefit of taking monsters out of the environment in a prison, let's say, well, then I think you're bereft of hope. You obviously believe that all men are created equal. It says so right in our Constitution. Let me explain something. All men are created equal under law. It doesn't spell that out in the Constitution, but that's clearly the intention. If you look around, you'll see the guy next to you is taller or shorter. He's fatter or skinnier. He's brighter or not as bright. He's lighter or darker. He's got longer hair, longer arms. He's a good boxer, a good dancer, and you're not. It's never equal. There's no such thing. And it doesn't take an intellectual moron to figure that out. It just takes, I think, some sort of courage to say that in our legal system, in our political system, we must have equality. We have to.
Is there room in the world, Jack, because it's certainly needed, but will there ever be space made for realism?
Oh.
For people who can see reality. I mean, you talk there, and to be honest, we'd have a reasonably good comprehension, we'll say, of, you know, of what you're talking about, just kind of within the kind of the American political system, because we have a little bit of a fetish for it on this side of the world. And I suppose maybe it's not just here, but I'd imagine it's a global thing, because at the end of the day, America is, you know, for better or worse, it is a superpower. So we have an understanding of your political system and kind of how it works and how it fails and, you know, kind of what doesn't work for it. And on a much smaller scale, because we are at the end of the day, we're a perished rock in the Atlantic here in Ireland. But we have something similar here in that our political system, we have a political elite. We have a bunch of middle-aged men in suits who, again, don't know the price of a gallon of milk, don't know the price of a gallon of gas, don't know the price of anything, because they don't need to know these things. But what they also don't know the price of, what they also don't know the cost of, is the cost of the decisions that they make that affect people way down the line. Now, you can talk about the death penalty, right? I mean, that is a very contentious issue. And you will always hear about the guy who was wrongly convicted and put to death and was exonerated posthumously and that. But I would imagine that percentage-wise, they are a small percentage of people who get killed on, you know, who get killed on death row. Because I would imagine that the vast majority of people who end up getting killed on death row have committed heinous crimes, and they're getting their punishment. But again, look, the whole thing of you know, whether it's right or wrong to take another human life, blah blah blah, that's a whole other conversation.
Blah blah,
right?
Blah.
That's a whole other conversation. But well, I mean, look, well,
that's the whole thing. It is, in fact.
But it is, you know, I mean, it's that kind of thing that all of the conversations around these things, they become white noise. And I think they become white noise, Jack, because really the people who need to hear these conversations don't give a shit.
Aren't involved in the conversations, right? They're busy with whatever they're busy with. They're certainly not standing next to me at Walpole. The reason for writing the book, I mean, there were two reasons. The first reason was because if I didn't write the book, I was in great psychological distress. And the book, I will tell you frankly, saved my life. It was a recommendation of my psychotherapist. My psychologist made the suggestion that I was angry and filled with rage and bitterness, and I was carrying on with drinking and other really destructive behaviors. And he said, well, you won't take medicine. I said, I'm not biologically depressed. What the hell would I be taking antidepressant for? I said, whiskey. That's my medicine. He said, well, whiskey's ruining your life. It's contributing to more problems. He said, you won't go in for behavioral treatment. You won't take my advice about getting on antidepressant. You won't take any of the suggestions that I have given you. Of course, probably no worse patient in the world than another psychologist. So he basically told me, I'm not going to stand around and hold your coat while you self-destruct. You're not taking my advice. Treatment is over. He said, I'll refer you to somebody else, but know this, I wouldn't discontinue treatment with you because I care about you. If I thought somebody else would be able to do a better job, I will give you the names of other therapists to cover my own ass legally. But what I suggest is that you make a decision to save your own life, because you're not going to do that unless you change something. And as I was going out the door, he said, well, Jack, you know, really, you're very articulate. Have you thought about writing any of it? That led to Sin Eater, the book that saved my life. But it saved my life a decade ago. All right. Over a decade. Mm. It saved my life, but it did a long time ago. The reason that I'm still futzing around with this thing now is because I want to put this in the hands or before the eyes of the sorts of people we're talking about who are responsible for making the decisions, creating the laws, doing the advocacy for prisoners and human rights. I need those people, those well-intended, well-educated, ignorant people to read and to understand what the world behind the wall really is all about. I say it's a monster factory. I'm not hyperbolizing. You're creating the problem. Pardon me. The problem is there in all civilization. Everybody has evil in them. This is part of human nature. It's not going to go away with prisons or without prisons. What prisons are doing is distilling the cream of psychopathology. I'll stop calling it evil because, you know, people in my profession will just dismiss me if I continue to call it that. I would put them into a room with men that I have worked with, and in 5 minutes, they'd be urinating and crying and banging at the door to get out. If that's not evil, I don't know. Maybe evil really isn't a thing. I was there with those men. I was in their hearts. I was in their minds. They allowed me into their lives. And I can tell you without fear of, I won't contradict myself, I guess. These men would be better off dead, and society would be better off with them dead. Now, I don't know if anybody's going to seriously look at my book, Sin Eater, after hearing me say that out loud. So you might want to do me a favor and just edit that out, so that people don't know clearly and decisively that that's really what the book is focused on.
I think that anything that involves holding up a mirror, it's always going to be met with resistance. It's going to be met with reticence, isn't it? I mean, it's going to be, you know, to hold, I suppose, you know, in one way. Well, look, I mean, that's something that you want for the book. Yeah. That's something that you want for the
book. I'd like to think that I'll be able to make that contribution before I pass on to the next level myself. But let me say this, Kevin, you seem like an extremely bright, and I've read your poetry, so I'm in love with you. The thing is, you have a noble soul. I could see it in the words you wrote. I don't know what to make out of this exchange. And please edit anything that you feel is, well, you will edit to suit yourself. But know this, if you put out my beliefs as I've articulated them in a podcast to the general public, you may suffer some blowback.
You know, I'm okay with blowback, and I'll tell you why I'm okay with blowback, because it's, as I said to you, the whole thing of holding up a mirror, unless there are people who are prepared to put their heads above the parapet and say, this is wrong, this is broken, this isn't working.
King right? has no clothes.
The emperor is naked. You know, I get where you're coming from, and I appreciate you giving me the get out there, right? But really, you know, where I was going to with this is that even outside of you hoping that somebody who makes policy or somebody who is in charge or in control of something will see the book and maybe it will give them pause for thought, or maybe it will kind of, you know, or it might come as a complete eye-opener to some people who are stuck so much within
that they don't know the price.
A tiny mindset that they don't realize what's going on. But I can tell you, from my perspective, as somebody who, and I'm honored to have read it because it's not even published yet, right?
Well, it is available at my website, and you should let people know that so they'll have to wait to have it published.
Okay, well, I'm making a note here, Jack, and what I'll do is I'll find it and I'll get it and I'll share it and I'll put it up there. But what I was going to say to you is that I have no say one way or the other, obviously, on policy in the United States of America.
Nor do I.
I'm nobody's congressman. I know, you know, but just from my perspective, as somebody who likes to read, and I'll be honest, I don't read very much fiction. I tend to read for information and enlightenment and whatever else, and you know, I like to read things that are you know, I like to read a bit of poetry and I like to read, but I do like a good biography and I do like a memoir. I like things that are written by people of people. And I found the entire thing from beginning to end just absolutely enthralling. And
it's not a memoir like the other memoirs.
Well, you know, do you know what I like about it? It cuts to the chase in that you get a lot of memoirs and you get a lot of biographies, and it starts maybe just with the early childhood experiences of the person writing it, and that's fine, that's lovely. But I mean, yours is, it's not a memoir of Jack McClintock. I mean, it's a memoir of a prison psychologist.
Thank you.
Right?
And thank you. And it's, I'd like to put that on the cover.
What, by all means, you do that, my friend. You put it on the cover, because the way I see it is that this is about your time within the prison service and the experiences that you had in there. And I purposefully didn't go to any of those specific experiences, because what I want people to do is I want people to get the book and I want them to learn about Jared for themselves. I want them to learn about the three Magi for themselves. I want them to read the chapter on strength and honor. I want them to get that themselves, because I suppose the purpose of this conversation, you know, and the previous conversation was that, you know, you and I would become properly acquainted and chat a bit about your book. Jack, can I ask you before I let you go, are you happy to have another conversation with me sometime?
I'd be delighted to. I tell you honestly, I am not. Yes, the answer is yes. So yes, period. But, and this isn't going to happen, at least I don't think it is. But if I can talk my wife into heading over to Ireland one more time, I would very much want to sit down with you at a pub.
I'm all for that. And it's something that I do very well, right? It's something that I do. That's something that I do very well, right? But it is, yeah, do you know what? We'll do this. But in the meantime, we can hope that we'll get to meet in person someday. But in the meantime, let's continue this conversation, because, you know, I would love at another stage to talk to you about your poetry collection, A Turn of Phrase. And you have another very interesting and intriguing work, another book called New Age Warrior.
That's a fiction, most of it.
But you know what? It's a fiction, but knowing what I know of you, I don't think what you put into that book, I don't think that you pulled it out of the air or picked it out of the
ether. You know me already.
Yeah, you see? I have a feeling that an awful lot of what's between those particular covers has come from deep within that formidable frame.
I think if you get around to reading A New Age Warrior, you'll start laughing when you realize who John Sonny McDonough really is.
Jack, I'm really looking forward to you and I chatting again. I have to say that, you know, recording this couple of episodes has been interesting, rewarding, and very engaging. And I think that when I, you know, and now you have a new expression, but when I laid out my stall for my podcast originally, I did say part of my plan was to connect with other fruitful minds, you know, as in people who like to create, and, you know, not everybody who is creative is involved in the arts. We've got to think creatively in many spheres of our lives, and we've got to function creatively. And I want to say that to you, that you're a force of nature, and it has been my absolute pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to talking to you again soon. So, author of Sin Eater, Memoirs of a Prison Psychologist, and I will give details in the sign-off of this episode as to where you, the listener, can go and have a read of this. Is it available to buy, Jack?
No, it isn't in print yet, but when it is, I'll let everybody I know be aware of that. I have it available.
So are you saying that you're giving it away on your website?
Sure.
That people can just go and read it?
Absolutely. Wow. As a matter of fact, anything on the website is free. If people wanted to give me money, that'd be great. I'd never say no. But the idea is to get this into the public and to get it before the eyes of people who might conceivably use it to learn and make a difference. I don't expect that. That's what I want. Before you go, thank you. You honor me with this. And I'm very proud to be involved with you in this way. I hope this adds to your success and the success of your website. And, you know, live long and prosper, Kevin McCormick. I was watching Black 47. And do you know the movie?
I do. I'm familiar with the movie.
You then know that the fellow who's strangled to death by the inspector at the very beginning of the movie. His name is McCormick.
Yep, he is. He is, and he wasn't the first McCormick to be strangled, Jack, and I doubt he'd be the last, because the way I'm going in some of the conversations I'm having, somebody's going to come for me one of these
days. Well, if they do, I'll try to take your back.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate
that. God bless.
Jack, I'm going to let you go, and I'll talk to you soon.
I look forward to hearing from you, Kevin. Thank you.
All right. Thanks again, Bye-bye. Jack. Thank you.
So yeah, massive thanks again to Jack McClintock for being so generous with his time. And speaking of generosity, as Jack mentioned during our chat, you can read Sin Eater, Memoirs of a Prison Psychologist for free online on Jack's website, where you'll also find other works by him as well for your enjoyment. Now, while Jack is offering all of his work free of charge on his website, I do know he would really appreciate you taking the time to leave a comment on the homepage of the site. Jack's website is, all the W's, etc., a-turn-of-phrase.com. So it's aturnofphrase.com with a hyphen between each of the words. And when you get to Jack's website, Sin Eater, Memoirs of a Prison Psychologist can be found in the drop-down menu there under Prose. Now, before I go, let me ask you, do you enjoy my podcast enough to buy me a pint once a month? And we're talking country prices now, not Temple Bar prices. Well, if you feel that you do, I'd really appreciate your support. You can become a patron of This Fruitful Mind at patreon.com/thisfruitfulmind. That's Patreon, patreon.com/thisfruitfulmind. And there is an underscore between this and fruitful and mind. So it's this_fruitful_mind. It's a bit complicated, I know, but I'm sure that if you go into Patreon and search for This Fruitful Mind, I'll come up there. Anyway, I'll talk to you soon. I have lots of interesting topics and engaging guests in the pipeline. But in the meantime, remember to be kind to yourself, gentle with others, and open to being brave.